Haz, I wanted to say sort of fair greetings to you on this fine May morn, but it isn't really, is it?
It's Mayan.
Could be October. We could be hunkering down and drinking cocoa right now.
Absolutely. In fact, we are drinking posh tea.
Thanks to you. Wow. Wittards. You hung out at Wittards.
It was £2 for £8. Say no more.
I feel slightly less special now, but all the same, I don't think I've ever had elderflower and apple tea before.
Well, you're welcome.
I think, is that an orchestral musician thing, to drink lots of tea?
Loads of tea. And there's the saying, nice guy, good player, gets the teas in. Getting the teas in is really important.
I can imagine that.
Yeah, it is. And also, imagine if someone was like trialing for a section and they came back and they were just holding one cup of tea. Like, nothing ruder. They could be the best player in the world and you just think, nope.
It'd be game over.
Yep, banned.
We're talking about orchestral musicians because that is actually the theme of this podcast.
It is.
As it happens.
Hooray.
But I suppose orchestral musicians will be in everybody's minds, particularly now, having seen the coronation service.
Absolutely. I mean, it goes without saying, there's so much amazing music there. And I saw loads of things on Facebook and online saying, you can't have this
without training them up.
Exactly. And the funding and the grassroots, and just, you know, suffer your little one to play the recorder for a little bit, because they could turn out like one of the amazing musicians that were at the ceremony.
I think that's so, we've just got to be more long-termist as parents, and the kids have to be as well, and just take the long line on this.
Yep. Absolutely.
A special shout out though to Bryn Terfel.
He was so good.
Oh my goodness me. It gives me the goosebumps just watching back after the event. And I think if I had to pick a highlight out of a very impressive service and a beautiful selection of commissions, it was the Paul Mellor and Bryn Terfel singing. It was the Agorius Trigavada, you know, Lord have mercy. And that just moved me so deeply.
Me too. And I'm no royalist, and I'm no, you know, I love a bank holiday as much as the next person, but we don't work 9 to 5. So as we'll find out with our orchestral musician interviews, but I actually got the link for the stream and sent it to my mum and was like, skip this, go to 48 minutes in. Bryn Terfel is singing a Kyrie in Welsh. It's beautiful. So I'm all for that. The more music, the better.
To plummet, I'm going to say, into the world of the orchestral musician, for it is a bleak and dark world on occasion. I just want to refer here, just to set the scene for our listeners, who might think that, you know, it might be all rosy. You know, you're playing beautiful pieces every day, you're on your instrument, you're doing what you love, etc., all these cliches. However, it has long been the case and long been proven that orchestral musicians have a particularly low job satisfaction. I mean, back in the 90s, there was a famous article in the New York Times that quoted, they did a survey, and basically the satisfaction of an average orchestral musician was below that of a prison guard.
Oh.
So either that means you've got some very jolly and fulfilled prison guards,
yeah,
or something's going wrong. It cited lots of stresses, but before we go into those kind of bleaker areas, how do you feel as an orchestral musician?
Great. But then I'm a freelancer, so I don't ever, you know, have a regular seat in an orchestra, which I think is one of the things that they teach you to do in music college. You get as best as you possibly can be, so that one day you can either become a soloist or have a seat in an orchestra, and that's it. And I think the job satisfaction being so low is because people work so hard all of their young life to get to this stage, and then they get to it and they're like principal bassoon, and they're like, right, okay, now, now what?
It's that emotional dissonance almost between the aspiration, as you say, throughout your training, throughout your young life, and you think, I've finally got there, and I now have to play the same Tchaikovsky symphony for an entire week under a conductor whom I don't adore.
Yeah, exactly. But that, you know, that said, that's usually like, this is me being really stereotypical, but kind of like the older, grumpier ones, the one who've had that seat for about 20 years or so. And then they've got this young student come up to side-by-side scheme and they're like, amazing, and they're playing amazingly and you think, oh God. And there's loads of, I think there's lots of grumbling, but you get that in any job. Maybe musicians are just more honest. So that when they're like, how are you doing? They're like, yeah, not good. But if you asked, you know, anyone else, like a fishmonger, how are you doing? They'll be like, yeah, not bad.
Okay, so slight difference. There are artistic egos involved there.
Yeah.
I mean, we can talk about the fact that you're in a very hierarchical environment, regardless of which generation you're from. You're still subject to the control of a conductor, even if that conductor's been collegiate and groovy, as the new generation are generally.
Mm-hmm.
They can't get away with the same tantrums of old. But still, you have very little control. I read in this same New York Times article that there was a surprisingly high correlation among the hobbies of orchestral musicians for hobbies that allow you to be in complete control of something, like orchestral musicians having their flying license, pilot license.
Definitely. I know loads of musicians who can, like, well, not loads, but yeah, like more musicians than non-musicians that can fly a plane. Does that
what
make sense?
Is that about?
I don't know.
Well, it's that, isn't it? It's
yeah.
It's kind of the displacement of feeling kind of in servitude to something and then just being in control.
I think it's from being very young and someone saying, hey, you're really good at this. Work really hard at something you love till you can monetize it.
Till you can fly.
Yeah, and then you're, well, like, and
in
then,
a way.
Yeah, exactly. And then you do it and then it's like, oh, well, now I do it as a job. That's why you see loads of musicians just crocheting. You know, and just doing something that doesn't bring them money just brings them joy and just nice happiness. But saying that, it is not all doom and gloom, because I've had some amazing chats with some wonderful musicians.
I feel a Hazetta coming on.
Oh, you're right. So I thought we would go through the different sections of the orchestra and ask them not the nitty-gritty questions, but just the sort of questions that I'd like to know.
Brilliant.
There are. So we're going to start with my good friend on harp, Margaret Hall.
Right, questions. How early would you be for a first rehearsal? What section would be the last to arrive? Harps arrive at least an hour before the start of the rehearsal, generally speaking, so that we can tune in piece. So yeah, about an hour before, possibly a little bit more if it was the very first rehearsal and it was a big deal like BBC or something. Last section to arrive, I would guess, would be some stragglers in the brass section somewhere. It's usually them who kind of waltz in a little bit late. That's hugely stereotypical, but never mind. Best and worst bits of the orchestral day. Ooh, golly. Best bits are the concert, I think. It's always the most fun bit and getting to do what we love doing. Social side, especially if you bump into people that you know and you're not expecting to. That's always really fun. But yeah, I mean, the concert is the best. Always. Has to be, I'd have said. Worst part of the day, for harpists, it's usually if there's no parking provided. So it's the getting in, getting out, harp drop-off, that stuff, that side of it. Logistics of parking, harp drop-off, all of that. Hoo-ha, the worst bit, and any like traffic stress getting to the venue. What piece do you dread playing? Oh god. Sagan, because it's a harp cadenza with a violin solo, and I think because it's Ravel and it's just so fluid and so whatever, Sagan would be a moment of terror. Although they're beautiful and wonderful, Strauss harp parts are generally terrifying. Amazing things to play, but terrifying and need a lot of work. The one that instantly comes to mind is Salome. Salome's dance tends to be on hit list for harpists of terror. Wagner's Magic Fire Music is another one, which as an exit in auditions is horrible, but again in the orchestra is probably slightly easier, plus you have to have a harp section of six, which is like a harp army, and that's really cool. So dread, but also would love to do it someday. And the other one that comes up, which is a joy, and again, it's easy in the orchestra, but it never ever feels easy, and it's so kind of important to do it brilliantly, is Symphony Fantastique. We don't do a lot, but you hear every single note, and it's just always uncomfortable, even though it's fun. Right, what is the piece you love playing? Oh God. Composer-wise, any Mahler symphony, and I'm in my happy place. Specifically, Mahler's Second Symphony. It's just the scale, the power behind it, the joy, the euphoria, just everything about it is just awesome. Awesome beyond.
Well, that was an interesting insight already into quite a few different aspects, both logistical and musical. I can testify to harps being there always super early to tune.
Yeah.
And because as a pre-concert speaker, I'm often having to negotiate space with the poor harpist who's desperate to tune their instrument. And, you know, come 6:30, I'm asking them to clear the space rather sheepishly. And they haven't always been told by the orchestra manager.
Not always. So parking and tuning logistics for harpists.
What a headache. Yeah. I mean, just the instrument itself. I mean, you see a couple of stairs and you break out in sweat with an instrument like that.
Yeah, it's true. Although I know it's stereotypical that the brass will be like, oh, last to arrive. But I think in terms of rehearsal, brass are always there warming up. And I always feel like, I mean, recently did a concert where we were waiting for the trumpeters to come back in so we could start the second half of the actual concert. And that was like, ooh. I was texting from my music stand saying, we're on. Like,
that's not a good show.
No.
Don't tell me they were propping up the bar.
I mean, they weren't drunk, but they were just having, you know, just a, you know, an interval hydration.
Well, that's fair enough. I mean, there are certain coping mechanisms that happen for orchestral musicians that we're all aware of. And it is orchestral life is rife with those kind of issues around addictions and coping mechanisms that can start to strangle you rather than liberate you.
Definitely. I mean, these boys weren't. They were just poor time management. They're idiots.
Fair enough.
But I've definitely been in the situation where you come home and you're like, well, that was a good gig, so I'll have a drink. Or, that went really badly, so I'll have a drink. And soon, you know, congratulations and commiserations both equal having a glass of wine. And that's not good. And I think any job you can get into that, but especially a job where you're looking out to the audience and everyone else is having a nice time and drinking, it becomes part of your almost daily ritual. So it's good to get out of that habit.
Plus, you're part of a team, aren't you? And if everybody's going out for a quick sort of pint afterwards, then it's harder to say no.
Exactly.
She talks as well about performance anxiety, which is such a big feature of an orchestral musician. I think we underestimate how much anxiety everybody's feeling. And in fact, there was a study where they took the blood and the saliva of musicians from each section of the orchestra before going on. And it turned out that the amount of stress in the first violins and the conductor was more than that combined of the entire orchestra. So it's, you know, it's quite high wire stuff.
I can see why. They're neurotic. Why would you choose an instrument that you have to play them, you know, mostly the main tune and really high up? And then you're standing so close to your boss.
The scrutiny on both sides. It's true, isn't it? Well, in fact, that's something that will be contested later by a second violinist, Sally Wynn, that I will interview, and I'll play that later. But you managed to get, I think, a voice from every single family of the orchestra.
I did. I really did. So Margaret said that if she could play any other instrument in the orchestra, it would be percussion or French horn. So I thought it'd be nice to go to... Curious, indeed. I would go to French horn next. And I have some answers from my friend who didn't want to do a little interview, but he has given me some answers to read out.
Oh, good. Okay.
So it's like me doing an interview now. So
could you do a special French accent?
I think he's Scottish, but I'm not doing an accent.
Okay.
So, French horn, when would you arrive? And he says at least an hour before to warm up and see what's happening with the instrument and my face that day. Gives me time to fix any issues that appear. But asking around to his friends, they all say, nah, he arrives 2 hours before. He's always there first. Wow. French horns, you know, he can be there to arrive, warm up, and then he can just chill then get a coffee and knows he's in the space and gets rid of that anxiety.
I love the thought of him fixing his face.
Fixing your face, yeah. I think it's really the interesting. Embouchure. Yeah, when they say putting my instrument to my face, it's very different. I mean, I put my violin, like my viola, to my face, but hopefully not that close. But yeah. So his worst bit is, and I definitely relate to this, but I feel so sorry for Brass and Wind when this happens, running the whole concert rep on the day of the concert.
Oh, yes. Exhausting for the lips.
Yeah, massively. Mm. And also for that emotion that you have, if you're playing, for example, Mahler Symphony, if you go through the whole rigmarole of getting really fired up and playing and getting into it and then feeling exhausted and that almost, it's like the petit mort or whatever is at the end when you have that little death.
Yeah.
And then you have to psych yourself up again to do it, like again in the evening.
I think that's lazy rehearsing as well sometimes. Mm. Sometimes to just say, do you know what, let's just do a run through. That's more for the conductor's benefit.
I was going to say, I hate it when the conductor says, oh, just for me, can we do this bit? And you're like, okay, is it really for you? Because if it is, no. But if it's for like that viola player who clearly can't get the rhythm, then just say, sort it out. You know?
Do you think, as you've brought out the conductor, can I just ask, you know, what is the general relationship to the conductor with orchestral musicians? I can obviously speak to how I feel when I conduct, and it's not always pleasant.
I mean, it's difficult when you're a freelancer, I guess, because you have one day with this one person. Mm-hmm. But then it's very easy because all of their little quirks and foibles you can instantly forget. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have a guest conductor in for the next 6 months, you're sort of sitting there like, oh my gosh.
Here we go.
Yeah. If they're great in the first rehearsal, you're like, this is going to be brilliant. But if you get into your mindset that this is going to be a slog, then it's horrible because you go into work every day with a colleague. Was it like having a boss that's like not very good at their job, but definitely gets paid more than you?
You know? It's not a great feeling. Anyway, back to the French horn.
No, conductors are lovely. They're grand. So the best bit is opening up the pad and seeing the word tacit.
Do explain that for our listeners.
So that just means you're not in this one. Don't play.
Yeah. Keep quiet. Keep literally.
Shush. Stum. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then I love this answer because it's my answer as well. The least favorite piece ever. And it's not because it's difficult. It's because it's rubbish, is Bolero, because it's repetitive and there's nothing to do.
Yes, that's the whole design of the piece, and I can testify to that as well. Just every single orchestra musician that I've met has this kind of deep antipathy to that level of repetition.
Yeah, awful. And then the best one, he chose Rosenkavalier because of the epic horn tunes and solos.
Oh, we've got to have a listen to some of that. Yeah,
absolutely.
So that's two bits of Strauss already as the faves that everybody gets to. I suppose Mahler has come up.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's so I don't know, generous in its lines.
That's a lovely way of putting it. He wrote for every single instrument in the mix.
Yeah, you all feel included.
Yeah.
Which is lovely. I think French horn is one of the hardest instruments ever. I mean, anything you have to put your hand into and then blow down, I think... Sorry, it's going to be tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, that's tricky.
Yeah. Moving swiftly on, my next interviewee was a percussionist. So I thought maybe they'd pick something with like loads of percussion in as their hated piece because they have to run around the stage. But that's not the case.
Right, it's my turn now. So how early would I be for the first rehearsal? So for the first rehearsal, I'd probably be there about 45 minutes to an hour before to kind of get all the percussion set up and get things where you need them to be. But on the second rehearsal, I'd probably be there about 30 seconds before the start. What section would be there last? I'd probably have to say the violas. Best bit about an orchestral day is any time you've got the whole percussion section playing something together, and that's always good fun. And the worst bit of an orchestral day is definitely either the setting up or packing down, because it's just a pain. What piece that I dread playing would have to be Bruckner 7. You sit there for about an hour to play one cymbal note, and then you probably miss it anyway. What piece that I love playing? I'd say I love playing West Side Story, as there's plenty to do in the percussion, and you usually get a doubling fee, so it's a bit of extra cash. And if I could play any other instrument in the band, I would have to play the second oboe, as they also seem to have very little to do at times.
That's so hip that he's doing that interview on a plane.
I know, right? A gigging, travelling musician.
Wow, what a status.
Yeah.
We should bring up the fact that that's one major perk, isn't it? Or perhaps a drawback if you're a family person, but the tours, which are now back in swing post-pandemic.
Yeah, and also you have to really juggle everything you might already have in your diary. So if you have, I've got a bit of teaching, I've got some work here and a concert and some music therapy and all these different stuff, and then someone says, we've got a block week of work, you then have to decide, who am I going to annoy? 20 people who have given me little bits of work, or one fixer who's given me loads of work, probably better paid, but I have to spend time away from home, so I need to think about that. And it's a bit of a minefield, and you always feel like you're going to be upsetting someone.
Yeah. A lot to juggle, emotionally as much as logistically. It was interesting that, you know, a nightmare for him is something like Bruckner 7, where you've got just oodles of rests and then one climactic cymbal strike. And, you know, people might think, well, he's being paid to do nothing. But that must be so deeply frustrating as well, as a highly trained musician, to be just perched on your chair for the most part of the concert, feeling a bit like a lemon.
But in full regalia as well, full tails, just standing there. And then the worst bit is sometimes when they stand you up at the end, stand the orchestra, and you haven't been playing for the last three movements. You know, I asked him to send me a link of that cymbal thing. I was like, oh, where is it? And he's like, I'm not going to find it. I never know where it is, and I always miss it. Like, that's case in point.
Well, I'm never booking him.
Well, quite. He did once get a doubling fee because in one opera he had to drop a pile of shovels off stage. So... you get, little perks of the job. Perks of the job. Hate myself.
We better just explain that doubling is when you get to sort of play on two or more instruments apart from your principal one. Mm-hmm. Happens a lot in the world of theatre music, which we're not going into today. But, I mean, the whole life of a pit orchestra musician is there's a completely different psychology when you're repeating the same work night in, night out. I mean, I remember just being an MD on a show for a short run of 15 shows. Mm. And just the pressure to try and up it somehow every night, or at least sustain what you've achieved the night before, is huge.
It's because, as well, because we are surrounded by the same people but different audience every night, sometimes you feel like, if I'm ever doing like improvisation, is I want to do something different for my friends, but what I did before really worked. So what if I do a really crap job tonight? And then, do you know that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your first duty is to the audience, I guess.
Yeah. Or Winter Marsalis says, the first listener is the player.
Oh, discuss.
Saw that on Facebook, yeah.
So we've had harp, we've had percussion, we've had French horn.
Yep. We're going to move on now to the woodwind section.
Excellent.
And this is our friend on oboe.
Our oboes generally, the oboes that I know, tend to be really quite organised.
Totally. This guy turns up again 2 hours, purportedly 2 hours before he needs to be. And he's always, and this is not my words, squirreling away at reeds in the corner. Like just, they just get there and they're like, right, got my place. And also they have to sort out who's playing what. Because something I didn't really realise is that if you have doubling or if you have more than one part, you have to divvy them up in the section.
Yes.
And the principals of the section are in charge of that.
You have to map that out.
Yeah. So it's another reason to get there early so you can be like, right, who's playing what, when?
I like the fact that you're bringing up how soon you have to get there before the call time, because this is the unseen work, right? Alongside that other whole unseen area of an orchestral musician's life, which is the training and the hours that you have to put in learning the part, particularly if you're a woodwind player.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also trying to work out then how much you're earning per day. For example, if the fee was a round number of £100 and you had a call that was like 2 till 5 and then a 7:30 concert finishes around 10:30, you have to arrive there for about 1 o'clock if you're, for example, a woodwind player, which means you leave the house an hour before, then you're paying £12.50 parking, you're paying for lunch, you have to, you know, you're doing things that you wouldn't usually do, like maybe go out for a pint or you might go for a coffee. And then by the time you get home, it's 11:30. And if you think, well, I left the house at 12, how much money am I making more than minimum wage? And if the answer is no, then what? What?
It sounds more as if you're making a loss, actually. Yeah, the way you describe it. Yeah.
And you're like, well, at least I love the music, but you played bolero. You know?
Man, no, it's a real sense of vocation, right? Mm-hmm. To stick at being an orchestral musician as the main part of your portfolio, because we have to stress that many orchestral musicians have to combine their orchestra job with teaching and various other sort of extra musical jobs.
Mm-hmm. And some people love it. So if you love teaching, do it. If you don't love teaching and you're just doing it as a top up, those poor kids, because that's when you get those really jaded, grumpy music teachers and you think, oh yeah, I used to play clarinet, but Mrs. Sowerby was a, you know.
Right, cynic.
Right, yeah, Sowerby. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Hello, Haz. Thank you for the questions. Here we go. How early would you be for the first rehearsal? For the first rehearsal, I usually arrive about 2 whole hours early because I have to make my reeds. What section would be the last to arrive? Trumpets. Best and worst bits of the orchestral day. The best bit of the orchestral day is when I give the A. No, not really. When we've had the first run through of a piece. The worst bit of the orchestral day is 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. and we're not out of there. What piece do you dread playing? I hate bolero. I have to play the oboe d'amore, which translates as the oboe of love. It's actually the oboe of death. What piece do you love playing? I love playing E.T. because for two reasons. It's got my favourite tunes in it. The horns sound amazing and I don't actually play very much in it at all, so I can listen to everyone else. And if you could play any other instrument in the band, what would it be? Any percussion that you have to play sideways.
I'd like to meet this guy.
He's really funny, isn't he?
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. So I like that he chose something by John Williams.
Yes.
That he said was the best piece to play. And it's really funny, again, that he says he hates bolero.
There's a definite theme going on there. And I have to say the E.T. theme tune is one of my favourite Williams tracks. So
definitely.
Let's have a listen. Just say I'm really enjoying this very fruity Wittard's tea.
It's gorgeous.
Other brands are available.
No, they're not. This is the one.
So we come now to the largest section, the strings. I mean, a harp is obviously a member of the string section.
Obvs.
But I feel I need to ask you the same questions.
Well.
So how early would you be for the first rehearsal?
Why are you laughing? Because I'm always late.
I think you have a very relaxed relationship to the clock, which I admire.
It's a liberate. Like, okay, my biggest fear, and I don't know why, but I always wake up in a cold sweat. Is it 2 p.m. or 2:30 start? I never know. And I always like have it screenshot on my phone for the gig that day. It's like, okay, it's 2 p.m. I will be late, obviously.
Wow.
But the last...
Passionately.
Exactly. Last section to be in... It's always violas because it's always me. Sorry.
Is that true though? Because that is the stereotype, isn't it?
Yeah.
The most laid back of the string tribes are the violas.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Why is that?
Because we didn't choose a higher up instrument that can permeate through the texture. We don't want the tune. We don't want the bass line. Don't give us any responsibility. Just a couple of off beats. And
and yet you are utterly indispensable. You are gold dust.
Stop it.
Well, it's true, isn't it? Educationally, it's very hard to get a violist. I speak from bitter experience. trying to sort of find this in the music school, you know, people who actually want to learn the viola. And yet, when you do persuade them to give it a go, the conversion rate is astronomical. People love it.
They do. Look for the very limby children. Anyone who's got more limbs than sense or just looks quite long in general, just give them a viola.
As if they could do basketball or something.
Yeah. Can you do sports? No. Great. Here's a viola.
Okay, yeah, put your lankiness to a new purpose. What are the best and worst bits of the orchestral day?
I love, this is awful because it's got nothing to do with music, but when you sat there and you're about to start and then you realise who you're sitting next to or who's around you, like, oh my God, hi, I haven't seen you in ages, and you have a little catch up. And the worst bits are, it's like when the conductor says something like, right, we're not going to go on till the end, we're just going to top and tail this. And then 3 hours later, you're like, we're not only going to the end, we are overrunning.
Yeah. That is very poor time management. Yeah,
which is, coming from me, which is fine if you said that you were going to go the full hog, but if you've promised someone that you're going to finish early and you don't,
That's bad. Ooh. But that's such a cardinal error. That's sort of surely blatantly obvious to anybody in a management scenario. Said he, just, I don't know, that ruffles my feathers. I just think that's poor conducting there. Or rehearsal management. Anyway, listeners, I am a conductor, or I'm a lapsed conductor that gets to wave now and then.
But you're also an orchestral musician, and I think that's what makes you a good conductor, can I just say?
Oh, thank you very much.
Because you know what it's like to be sat in the chair looking up at someone who's like got full control of 100 people. And if you don't go crazy with power, then you're a good guy.
I like to think I've got empathy.
Mm-hmm.
So which piece do you dread playing?
Bolero.
And which piece do you absolutely love playing?
Chaik 5.
Tell me why.
All of the tunes, all of the time. It's such a joyous play. And when you get to the final movement, it's just, you just keep going on the upwards trajectory. And it's just so much fun.
Shall we have a little bit of that finale?
Let's do it.
Never fails to stir.
Rousing.
So thank you so much, Haz, for that expanded Hazetta.
Oh.
And what a survey that's been. I hope that's lifted the veil for many listeners on the realities of an orchestral musician's life. I have to say, though, there are a lot of jolly sounding people there still.
Yeah, people don't take it too seriously and just enjoying music and enjoying playing music with other people.
The camaraderie of it, right?
That's it. It's like having an office, but you go around with them.
Just a quick look ahead to our June podcast, which will be very sadly the final one of the season. And we hope to continue.
Yeah.
In the autumn.
Well, I'll be here every month. Sorry, John.
Maybe we just continue anyway, yeah. Right? Regardless of funding. But we hopefully will be speaking to a celebrity because we've heard from the rank and file musicians. Mm. And now we'll be speaking about the realities of the life of a celebrity musician. Mm-hmm. On the cards, if we're lucky, is Sheku Kanna Mason, the cellist.
If not, I'm free.
That's fantastic. Yeah, you've got a fallback.
Great.
I have a little black book of musicians on whom I'm sure you know some celebrities.
I'd never tell.
She's looking very tight-lipped. Anyway, that's what's to look forward to in June. So until then, it's goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.